Welcome to Compassion Collective. This episode is brought to you by your hosts, Michaela Swee and Susan Murray, co-founders of Compassion Collective. Music by singer-songwriter Michael Shines. On today's episode of Compassion Collective, we're very excited to welcome our guest, Dr. Steve Bisgare. Steve is a licensed clinical psychologist in private practice working with clients in New Jersey and Pennsylvania. His therapeutic orientation is rooted in acceptance and commitment therapy, ACT, and cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT. He specializes in the treatment of anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, substance use, chronic pain, and chronic health issues, including long COVID. Steve received his doctorate in clinical psychology from Widener University's Institute for Graduate Clinical Psychology. He completed a fellowship at the CBT Center for Anxiety and OCD in Media, Pennsylvania, and he serves as the current president of the Pennsylvania chapter of the Association for Contextual Behavioral Science, ACBS. You can learn more about Steve and his work at bisgaertherapy.com. That's bisgaertherapy.com. Steve, thank you so much for joining us here today. We're really excited to have you with us.
Thank you, Michaela, and thank you, Susan. It's a pleasure to be here.
So to get us started, just for our listeners, one thing that I mentioned a couple of times when I introduced you in your bio, mm-hmm. I mentioned ACT, Acceptance and Commitment Therapy. Can you start us off by briefly describing what ACT is?
Sure. Acceptance and Commitment Therapy, or ACT, is a transdiagnostic therapy that utilizes acceptance and mindfulness strategies and values-based behavioral change strategies, amongst other things, to help people learn how to deal with whatever life throws at us, whether that be difficult external experiences, or maybe even more importantly, difficult internal experiences like thoughts, feelings, memories, urges, even physical sensations. Mm-hmm. And ultimately learn how to deal with these things in a way that the goal ultimately being a rich and meaningful life.
And when you said values-based before, can you describe what you mean by that, values-based?
Sure. One of the core components of the ACT model is values. When we talk about values, we're talking about principles, ways of being that are personally meaningful. A big part of doing, I think maybe any therapy, but certainly in doing acceptance and commitment therapy, is figuring out for yourself what your values are, what qualities of ongoing experience are important to you. Compassion, by the way, kindness, these are values that we think of as possibly being universal values. But something that might be very meaningful to you, and then learning how to orient towards those values in your day-to-day behavior. So we talk about values-based behavior change. So there might be a lot of reasons why you want to engage in a certain behavior. I suppose, not to rank the different reasons, but a good reason maybe for engaging in a certain behavior is because it's consistent with the person that you want to be. It's consistent with your values. So that's a big part of the ACT model.
And one of the things that I love about ACT, it's a therapy, but it's also a way of living and a way of being. Mm-hmm. So for people,
I try not to sound, I sometimes introduce that ACT that way, but I worry, I try not to sound too like cultish, that it's not just a therapy, it's a way of life. But it really is a guide for what we might call, psychological wellness. mobilized as a therapeutic modality.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I think one question I have is, you know, for people who are maybe listening who are not in therapy or, you know, who are just curious about how to live consistently with what you're talking about, how would you sort of put that into words? It sounds like it's really about identifying what matters to you.
Yeah, I think there's a couple different sides to it. So there is this piece of being able to not only identify what matters to you, and we have different ways of helping people do that, but then also being able to orient towards that. And but that comes with some, you know, and then actually engaging in behavior on that path. Obviously, that is very challenging. You'd think, I suppose, if it's consistent with the person you want to be, that would mean that it would be easy and straightforward. But that's almost never the case. It turns out that very often trying to engage in purposeful, meaningful action means taking some risks, challenging yourself, exposing yourself to things that you care about. Almost inevitably, and this is part of just being human and the human condition, is that if we're going to open ourselves up to things that mean something to us, then we're going to take the risk of having that go wrong, of potentially losing those things or of falling short. So it can come with deciding to go down this path can come with a lot of icky feelings, a lot of very and icky, of course, being a very sophisticated term, but maybe too gentle a term. It can come with some really hard stuff, some very difficult internal experiences, and also potentially set us up for some potentially difficult external experiences. And so the other part of psychological wellness, or the other part of the ACT model, is learning how to, I suppose, deal with those things, those difficult thoughts and feelings and even physical sensations and external experiences, learning how to have a different relationship with them, learning useful strategies for dealing with them that actually work and open up the possibility to continue to engage in that behavior. I guess I could get a little more specific if that would be helpful.
Well, one thing I was curious about is I wanted to jump on, you had mentioned compassion earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And I was curious how you think of self-compassion and how self-compassion comes into play with these sort of acceptance-based practices or ways of living.
Terrific. So I don't think you can really talk about psychological wellness without talking about compassion. Let's start by defining compassion. I don't have the perfect definition of compassion.
I don't think one exists.
I think of it, I try and keep everything simple. Cause it's tends to get messy when I let myself be complicated. And so when I keep things simple, I think of compassion. I think of a couple ingredients. I think of the presence of suffering. The presence of pain. And I think of a kindness, a caring towards that suffering, an acknowledgement of it, a thoughtfulness about it, and a kindness towards it, whether it's self-compassion, kindness, and an openness to our own suffering, or compassion towards others, the same thing. I don't know. Ultimately, in terms of how it overlaps with ACT, I think probably every component of the ACT model has some of the like compassion sauce in it, like, or if we're making like different ingredients in this soup, like none of the ingredients are really wholly independent. They all include parts of the other ingredients in them. And I think maybe it's bi-directional. So let me be a little specific. Let's use the big, the word that ACT is most known for is acceptance. And it's one of the key processes that we see as part of wellness or as part of psychological suffering when we turn away from acceptance. And so when we talk about acceptance in ACT, we're really mostly talking about internal experiences. We're talking about difficult, unpleasant, and often unwanted thoughts, feelings, memories, physical experiences. And we're not talking about liking them, like learning to love these difficult internal experiences. And we're also not talking about resigning ourselves to them as though like, oh, you know, life sucks and then you die. Like that type of pessimistic, kind of cynical attitude. That's not what we mean when we say acceptance.
Right.
When we say acceptance, we're talking about willingly making room for these difficult internal experiences, kind of opening up and having a place for them, as opposed to avoiding them or fighting them, getting kind of what we've found is that efforts to avoid or control these difficult internal experiences often look a lot like fighting, struggling in quicksand. That like the more you kind of fight against them, try and push away from them, the more salient they get. They actually take on a more important quality in your life. Or alternatively, the techniques we might use to avoid them it may pose their own set of problems. So for example, you know, we might avoid some difficult feelings with various intoxicating substances. Might be like a really good strategy in the short term for avoiding a difficult internal experience. We might just avoid the very thing that maybe is engendering that difficult experience, the difficult internal experience. So I might close myself off to certain challenging opportunities, or maybe I avoid relationships because of the different painful experiences I've had or the memories I've had. And so we find these strategies that we use to avoid or control or manage the difficult internal experiences end up being more trouble than they're worth ultimately. I'll say one thing here. If they're not more trouble than they're worth, if they work for you, then at least under the philosophy of ACT, then, you know, great, go for it. Anything that works towards a full, rich, meaningful life, you know, go for it. You don't like have to accept things. But particularly if not accepting them is working for you in some way. That said, if you step back and look at these behaviors you're doing and you find that actually the avoidance moves, the control moves that I'm putting towards my anxiety or my fear or my sadness, you know, isn't working for me. Ultimately, my life's getting smaller over time, or I'm acting in a way that's inconsistent with the person that I really deeply down want to be, then it might be worth trying something different. And that's where, we end up turning towards this willingness and acceptance. Might I be willing to face some of these fears, experience some of my sadness in the service of taking action more consistent with the person that I want to be? Okay, so that I attempted there to do acceptance in a nutshell there and willingness in a nutshell. I can turn it towards self-compassion now if that sounds like a good place to go.
Sure, yeah. It's up to you. I think one thing that's kind of interesting to think about right now too is how when we're talking about this idea of willingness and turning toward pain, or difficult internal experiences, yeah, as opposed to away from them, you know, what does that look like? How, what are some ways in real time, in the present moment, to do that? I think it's, mm-hmm. it's easy for people to think like, oh, well, that sounds really good. Like, yeah, I want to do that. But then when it actually comes up and we're feeling that resistance and that urge to fight it and make it go away, what does that actually look like when that's arising? How does one do that?
Oh, that is a great question. that I would love to have like a really simple answer to that. And so I will try to. I think practice is one of the like the first words that come to mind. I think when you like I kind of cringe a little bit when I see articles that are like, you know, five steps to right. happiness. Because while I like the idea of those articles, they're trying to boil down some things that do really work ultimately if we practice them. It sometimes does take a lot of practice to actualize some of these strategies. And so willingness, for example, I think takes some practice. If we've spent a lot of our lives, I can speak to this from personal experience, if we spent a lot of our lives responding to that initial feeling of anxiety or fear that comes over us. Maybe it's even not even a thought. Maybe it's like, for me, it's my, I get like this tightness in my stomach, or I get this feeling in my body, like I'm crawling out of my skin, like this restlessness. I sometimes get that feeling before I've even really even had thoughts about being anxious or scared. And if you've spent a lot of your life responding to that kind of instinctively, like with an avoidance move or with a, you know, trying to make yourself feel better in that moment, that's going to be a habit then. It's not just instinctive. It's now been learned, and it's going to take some practice to be able to stay with that experience, allow it to be there, not fight it, not turn away from it. What that's looked like in my life, and again, it's taken, I think I've brought a lot of different things to the table to try and help build this skill. It's still something that I practice frequently. It's like an everyday sort of thing that you practice anew every day. But one of the things that it took was learning to notice what that story was like for me. If the goal here is developing a different relationship with ourself, a different relationship with these internal experiences, right? If my relationship before has been one where I took those experiences as a signal that something was wrong and that I needed to do something about it right now and escape it or avoid it or feel better about it in some way, if that's the relationship I've had, and the relationship I want to have is one where I kind of interpret that signal differently. I learn more about it. I have a more open attitude towards it. If I'm more willing to have those experiences and let them be there, then I need to kind of get to know it a little bit better. And one way of getting to know it better that I often recommend to my clients or to groups maybe that I'm working with in workshops is I personally found it really useful to give my mind, give my thoughts and feelings a name, like Bob or like Susan or Michaela, or, you know, you could use any of our names. Although it's funny, I normally recommend picking a different name, but for myself, I actually named mine Tiger Steve. which is, it's funny to share that with whoever's listening. But
was this in light of Tiger King or
no? Oh gosh, no. No, I would not pick a name that had a really salient meaning to you. I think Tiger King probably would be a poor name to pick at this point. It's a little too visceral. We want to develop a kind of kind relationship with this person, maybe, and not to say that you couldn't have that with Tiger King, but maybe pick a neutral name. I actually picked Tiger Steve because I realized that the way my mind, whenever I get kind of face a challenging situation, something that's going to challenge me in any way, my mind tends to respond as though there's a literal tiger lurking on the horizon, and I need to be afraid, and I need to be really on guard, and I need to escape the situation. Maybe the threat is as though I might lose my limbs or die, and that my mind and body really reacted this way in any sort of kind of challenging, I mean, not literally that way, like I needed to run from a tiger, but pretty close, you know, my body got activated. I found myself doing avoidance moves left and right, in the same way that I would adaptively avoid a tiger. And my mind would have all sorts of catastrophic thoughts of things that could go wrong, and I might embarrass myself, or I might, you know, I might disappoint people, or all these different things. And I learned that's what my mind liked to do. And that was really helpful, actually, in developing a new relationship with him, is starting to notice the stories he would tell me. And to notice that he'd tell me these stories very, very often at times when I was actually doing something that I wanted to do. Something that, like, in the big picture was important to me. And I use examples like things that cause anxiety, right? Like, it could just be going to work and having, maybe even getting a promotion or having to give a talk, or going on a first date or meeting new people. Any number of things, anything really that we might put on the list of something, some sort of meaningful goal that we have for ourselves, I found came with some vulnerability, some risk. And as I kind of learned to notice those experiences, not as a signal that there was some tiger coming, that I was going to get torn limb from limb, that like I had to avoid it or else, but I actually started to learn. And now again, this took practice and took some time and some learning. And some like reflection, and honestly, some of my own personal therapy over the years. But I started to learn that this wasn't really a signal that there was a tiger lurking. This was a signal that Steve was doing something meaningful. Was about to do something that he cared about. And to the extent that he wanted to do things he cared about in my life, I was going to have to open up to some of these thoughts and feelings and memories and urges, et cetera. And then I'll finish with kind of this thought. The more I practiced staying kind of with those experiences, so you say, what does it look like practically? Well, let's say I sit down. Let's say I'm a student working on an essay, for example, that's due, or a presentation in class, or I could be an employee working for a company on a presentation that's due, or some assignment. And I think we've all had that experience of wanting to look at Instagram instead, or wanting to look at Facebook or Google stuff or go on YouTube, right? And really what that is, I think most of the time, is it's an avoidance move. It's a control strategy. We've had some sensations, maybe consciously, maybe, you know, unconsciously, but we've had some experience of like, oh, I'm a little anxious about doing this right, or, oh, I don't really want to do this. It's going to be hard. Have found over the course of our lives that simple click over to Instagram or to YouTube provides this instant sense of like relief from those difficult experiences. I certainly am very familiar with that avoidance strategy. I think it's very human, very 21st century avoidance move. And what willingness looks like is first, I talked about this a little bit, noticing that story is playing again. It happens in like an instant. that anxiety, fear, sadness, worry, you could just call it discomfort, is happening, and that it would be really nice to get relief from it by going down a YouTube rabbit hole. And what I'm going to do instead is I'm going to notice that this is hard. Something about this is hard. I may not even know what it is. This is just some stupid thing I'm supposed to do at work. I don't even think I care about it. But something about it is tough. And continuing to work on it is going to mean a little bit of suffering. And let me see if I can make some room for that. And again, bring a little compassion to this space, depending on the suffering. I'm using a stupid assignment at work, but maybe this is something that I really care about. Maybe this is going to see a friend, and maybe that produces a lot of, you know, worry for me. Maybe I'm endeavoring down some goal that I've set down many times before, and I've had a lot of struggle with that. And so it's really kind of scary to try to go down that path again. But on some level, I know that it's really meaningful to me. And so I'm going to kind of make room for the fact that this is scary. And wow, there are some painful memories here. And this is hard. And you know what? One little step at a time, I'm going to give myself a chance. I'm going to take this risk. I'm going to stay with some of this pain. I'm going to make room for it. And I'm going to endeavor one little step at a time down this path, whatever that looks like for me in that moment.
One of the things that I love about how you're talking about this is that it seems like inherent in how you're orienting towards willingness and action is already imbued with compassion and gentleness and understanding, a validating of how difficult this is. I can see someone also just seeing, okay, I have to be willing to do this. I have to kind of grin and bear it or grit my teeth and do this thing. And I think what you're proposing is that there can be this gentleness involved.
Yeah, I think actually there could be room for both. I think sometimes we get, and I can fall prey to this too. So I want to make room for gritting our teeth. I want to be flexible, right? That's a big part of what we do is we try and be really flexible. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes I can fall into a trap of getting on a little bit of a high horse of acceptance. And like that we need to bring this, or even a high horse of self-compassion and compassion, and we need to be really have this gentle spirit and make room for this stuff in a loving way and hold ourselves in this really kind way. And I do think that that's all really important. I also do think there's times where sometimes, you know, we're about to do something really tough and challenging and we're scared and we're anxious and sometimes we do have to, you know, I even think about like my little toddler, where sometimes you just gotta like bite the bullet and go for it. And like, there's gonna be like an edginess to that and a little bit of, there might be a little bit of white knuckling it, like just holding on and going for it. And I think sometimes if that, attitude helps you move in a valued direction, one that's been difficult for you to go, then like go for it. Grit your teeth and just go for it. I think there
can be room. Need to judge it.
Yeah, I think there can be room for that in facing a challenging, you know, getting yourself over these hurdles.
Yeah, thank you for clarifying that for me.
Sure. Oh, you know, my pleasure. I will say that there's a space when we kind of go, I think sometimes gritting our teeth, treating life as something that we have to like fight for all the time, that we're always in this like never-ending struggle in order to achieve what we're looking for. You know, I don't want to live that way either. That doesn't sound workable to me. And I have found that a lot of times, and I found this a lot working with perfectionists, that it's a little bit of a lie we tell ourselves that the only way to motivate ourselves is to like crack the whip, or that we need to be like self-punishing. This is a big misconception about self-compassion, actually, a big misunderstanding, I think, about self-compassion and acceptance, is the idea that there's like some weakness to it. And that if we're too kind to ourselves, then we'll never get anything done. There's research that contradicts that. There's, I can speak anecdotally that it's just not true. That sometimes actually what we need to get over those hurdles isn't a whip. It's funny, it's my own personal experience. My toddler is coming to mind, an experience I just had where he was a little bit, scared to come down from, he was up on this like ramp and he was a little bit scared to come down. And so I got down I was down at the bottom of this little ramp and I got down real low and I opened my arms and I smiled at him and I don't know what I said, like, come on, you can do it. Here I am. And, it was really that kindness and my open arms at the bottom there that helped him get over that hump, that fear of like, I don't know if I can come down this, I might fall.
Right.
Ultimately, that's all to say that I think self-compassion and this kindness is actually a more potent, weapon, if you want to weaponize kindness, but a more, like a
that's
more-
just potent, what we were hoping to do.
Yeah, a more potent motivator even to encounter a lot of this stuff is to do it from like a place of like, of love.
I think that that's a really important comment, because I was thinking earlier about what you were saying, Steve, in terms of meaningfulness, what matters to us. And when you were talking about Tiger Steve, I was thinking about how a lot of times when our own Tiger Steve comes up, when we feel that threat, whatever that threat may be, it's also the time I've noticed for myself that a lot of self-criticism comes up at the same time. Like, why am I feeling this way? Why am I reacting this way? I don't want to feel this way. I don't want to react this way. And what you were making me think about earlier as you were speaking is just about how that's also a time to direct tenderness and kindness to that critical voice, to understand if something's meaningful to you, the stakes are high.
Right.
So this, you know, jumping into self-criticism is also a really natural form of self-protection. Now, it's not necessarily helpful to us in all moments.
Not always.
Right. But not always at all.
Incredibly instinctive.
Yeah, incredibly instinctive. And I think it's helpful for me in those moments when I'm feeling whatever that sense of threat is, and then my self-critic kicks in and I'm judging myself for feeling and reacting to the threat. It's really helpful for me to then also be able to direct self-kindness and, as you were saying, tenderness and caring toward that response, to then be able to say, like, this matters to me. Of course I'm reacting to defend or protect this. Right. And how might I be able to do that differently in this moment?
Yeah, like there's something to lose here.
Yeah,
exactly. How could I help but have some insecurity, to feel some self-doubt? The reality, unfortunately, or whatever judgment you want to put on it, is that there's something to lose going in the other direction as well. I think one of the nice things we do in one of the nice things that's come out of some of the ACT literature, again, I think all therapies, I reference the ACT literature a lot because I'm very well versed in it and I'm very familiar with it. So I just want to throw that out there. I might say something's coming from the ACT literature, and actually it's coming from like Buddhist literature from 2,500 years ago, or it's coming from, you know, psychodynamic literature from 80 years ago. ACT ultimately is relatively recent, and so it's infused with the wisdom of the past. But so something that I'm familiar with from the ACT literature is the idea of a choice point. That in really every moment, but in particularly moments where we notice ourselves anxious or fearful or about to, we're at a moment where we have a choice to make. And one of the choices is to orient towards the internal experiences that, you know, I'm scared. And so therefore I should do something about the fear. I should maybe avoid it. I should make a move away from the internal experience and ultimately away from the valued direction, away from maybe the person I want to be. Or we have a choice to make a towards move, towards the person we really want to be, towards the our valued self, towards that valued goal potentially. And the truth is that making the away move, the reason we so often make away moves is that they feel better in the short run. It feels better to go onto YouTube. It feels better to stay in your bed in the morning. It feels better to have a glass of or six glasses of beer in the short run, so we're so often pulled in that direction. In the short run, making towards moves often comes with an exacerbation of those difficult internal experiences. I'm even maybe sweating more. I'm more anxious. I'm maybe even more scared. I'm becoming more vulnerable. The lie we tell ourselves is that that means that the towards moves are harder, that the towards moves are scarier. I'm using strong language because I think it's an important point to be made. That's really a lie. It might be a more difficult path in the short run, but when you work with people who have spent from personal experience, when you look back at times in your life where you've consistently made these away moves, when you've chosen these short-term strategies that maybe feel good in the short run, the ultimate result of that path is real pain, real suffering. That's the path that I think really contributes to the deepest, the most profound suffering, the loneliness, the isolation, the real dysfunction. And that, by the way, can be a helpful frame when we were talking about different things we can do, ways we can bring compassion or kindness to a moment, is we can kind of remind ourselves at these choice points that, hey, I'm about to do something that is really, really meaningful to me. In the long run, it's very likely to lead to like fulfillment and satisfaction. And sure, it might lead to disappointment and struggle, and I might get my heart broken, right? That's part of the risk of having meaningful relationships. But boy, oh boy, the alternative, holy smokes. It's like, I can avoid heartbreak. There's an easy way to avoid heartbreak, right? Which is just, I'll just break my heart right from the start. I'll just not have any relationships. I'll just close myself. I'll like, let me just get that ball rolling on breaking my heart. I'll just start with a broken heart. I certainly, you know, don't want to minimize that. I mean, I am talking about this stuff from real personal experience, which I think is important to relay because it helps. I want to know that I feel like we're all in this boat together of making these choices that can contribute to suffering. And there's no shame in that or judgment about that. That's part of being human too. But if we can access that wisdom at these choice points, that it's like, you know what, I don't want to live that way anymore. I want to try not to live that way anymore of avoiding and of cutting myself off from the possibility of a fulfilling life. And so I'm going to kind of turn towards some of this difficult stuff. I'm going to take the risk of going for this. And boy, oh boy, I hope that I can bring a little bit of compassion and kindness to that, because that's going to be hard. My heart is beating faster. I am sweating more. I am more scared. There are these painful memories. Oh, this is really hard stuff. And you know, here we go. Okay. This feels like, this path based on my own experience and as best as I can estimate at the time, this is the path towards what I really care about, towards being the man or the woman or that I really want to be.
Mm. It does seem like
you can hear me. I get carried away with this stuff. I'm not.
Oh no. That was beautiful. Sounds like some of you had talked about like ingredients earlier, which I like. Mm. Some of the ingredients to doing what you're talking about include courage, vulnerability, and a little bit of hope.
Uh-huh. Yeah, those are
I'm curious.
Word courage all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I really think it's important that we honor that. I think sometimes we could forget, especially when we've been a little bit down the road towards wellness. If we've been in the suffering space and then we've taken some steps towards wellness and we've kind of started to practice some of those steps and we've learned how like, wow, this stuff really works. And it tends to be that a lot of this stuff is pretty simple. But it's not easy. It can be simple.
One of my favorite things to say is that it's simple, but not easy.
But not easy. Yeah. Good for you. I think that's a great thing to say and to hold on to and remember, because, we could lose track of how hard it is. We could lose track of the fact that this is going to mean facing some stuff that people may have started burying down long, long, long ago as little people. There's some real pain in a lot of this stuff. It might be surfacing. It might be manifesting on at today's date as like a very basic away move. We might be saying like, oh, you know, this, you know, just go do this. It would be so simple. And we might lose track of the fact that the foundation of that away move is rooted in some really profound pain. And so it's going to take a commensurate amount of courage then. There's going to have to be a place for this person to really bring all of their resources to bear on this new behavior, which is going to take not only a lot of courage, there's going to be some faith involved, some faith in the process, you use the word hope. I think that's an equally good word, like some having hope, right, implies that we have this belief that this could end up working out, mm-hmm. which if you're in real despair, sometimes that looks like faith. Like you don't actually, you know, your mind, your Tiger Steve does not believe that there's any chance this is going to work out. You've maybe really have kind of lost hope. And so sometimes what it takes then is some faith that, you know what, this therapist or this, you know, book I'm reading, this author or this friend of mine or my partner believes that this could be the case. And so I'm going to have some faith that if I bring to bear my courage and, you know, perseverance, and I really kind of go for this, then I kind of have faith that maybe it could work out.
Right. And I'd love to go back to something you said earlier of you're going to lose something in the other direction if you don't take some of those steps. Mm-hmm. I think that that's worth talking about, just like you were saying, you know, you lose contact with continuing to build a meaningful life for yourself. So even if you've kind of lost hope or don't feel like you have a lot of faith, it's almost like you can think about all that you're losing by not engaging in this process.
Yeah, I do think that's important to recognize. And I do think ultimately that is why a lot of people come to a therapy office, for example, is that they've recognized that kind of everything that have tried to do. And I do think, and people come to me and they have tried a whole lot, Right. And to some success, by the way, they're still like living, and a lot of people still do have a lot of stuff going for them in their lives. And they've been trying really hard, but ultimately they're not content with the results. There's like a respect that whatever it is I've been doing isn't really working here. I'm missing out on things that I care about. And sometimes they're not even conscious of that, or they can't even like put like a list to it, but there's a sense that this isn't the life I want. This isn't the person I want to be. There's some, pieces missing here. That's when we want to have the skill and the ability to make room for it.
And in terms of sort of the evolutionary value of some of these trickier things that we often work on when we're doing self-work or therapy, one of the things we often talk about in the realm of self-compassion is self-criticism. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious if you have any thoughts on how we've evolved to be self-critical in some ways, how that's been valuable to us in some ways.
Oh, I sure do. I sure do. And actually, this was an important part of how I kind of came to grips with my own self-criticism. So I'm glad you asked that question. So I've talked a little bit about cavemen. I mentioned cavemen. Cavemen are an important part of this equation. And cavemen, by the way, were not, you know, we're talking about 5,000 years ago to about a couple hundred thousand years ago. So for most of the time that that's most of human history. The world was a very, very dangerous place. Still is a very dangerous place in many ways, right? But for many of us, not quite so dangerous as it was for cavemen. In those days, bigger animals, faster animals, stronger, big teeth lurked around every corner. And it was essential to your survival that you were always on the lookout for threat. If your mind didn't do that job well, if you didn't worry constantly, right, you'd soon be dead. There's a bear. Could there be a bear in that cave? Is that a wolf in the bushes? Is that human on the horizon, a friend or a foe? Not only did you have to be worrying about what could come next, right? And by worrying, all the different things that could go wrong, all the different mistakes we might make. You also privileged, your brain's privileged bad experiences that had happened, painful experiences that had happened. If you survived an attack with a lion, for example, it was really important that you remembered that. And that you told everybody that, like, you went around to your other cave people and said, you're not going to believe these lions. And remember, like, what went wrong? What happened to your fellow cave person? You know, maybe your daughter cave person who got eaten by the lion. What could you have done better? What did you do that enabled survival? And you replayed that over and over. You carried that with you for the rest of your life. These are the minds that we inherited from our ancestors. We're minds that are replaying painful memories where things went wrong, maybe where we made mistakes or where we were hurt. Over and over and over again, trying to figure out, by the way, you talk about self-criticism, what did you do wrong, right? There's not much you can control about that lion. What could you have done better? Why did you get eaten by the lion? Or why did you lose your leg? Or why did you end up being the one that was embarrassed, right? We take responsibility for these things in the name of survival. What could go wrong? What are all the things that might go awry in the future? This is what we inherited. There's more. The other, and this one maybe I think is even more relevant to the self-criticism, the other crucial ingredient to your survival was that you belonged to the tribe, right? If your tribe kicked you out, and this was for thousands and thousands of years, and by the way, to some degree is still true. If your tribe kicked you out, good luck with the wolves, right? You'd be dead in an instant. Belonging to the tribe was essential. So your mind evolved to do something really important. Compare. It evolved to compare you to others. Am I fitting in? Am I following the rules? Am I doing anything that could get me kicked out of the group? Am I contributing enough? Am I doing it well enough? And ultimately, am I good enough? Now, this was really important to your survival and actually continues to be somewhat useful, a pretty useful adaptive thing that our minds does. One of the things that makes it so tough in 2020 is that our tribes are no longer, you know, six people or 50 people. We now, we actually now, for most of us, we carry with us in our pockets these cell phones, which enable us to immediately connect with an enormous swath of humanity. Our tribes are literally billions of people big. And so I joke about how there's literally nothing about me that I'm not well aware of, like hundreds of thousands of people who do it better than I do it. If I go looking around for a way that I'm not contributing as much as other members of my tribe, right? I mean, that's almost a joke. It doesn't take long to find examples of weaknesses I have or ways in which I'm not good enough. And so as a result, we're all walking around with some version of this I'm not good enough story. The brain is hardwired to figure out ways you're not good enough. And it does that. It really ends up taking the form of beating you up, of kind of saying like, oh, you should be better at this. If you're going to, you know, you may not want to do that. You could embarrass yourself and the tribe might kick you out. Or, you know, you might not want to open up about this. What if they don't like it? What if they judge you? What if they, you know, what if they criticize you? What if you don't fit in? Or you're already noticing ways in which maybe you're struggling to keep up, or there's something at work that you're not as good at these people at doing. And so your mind is actually hardwired to beat you up for that. Even when the lesson has been like well and truly learned, even if there's not much here that you can control, for the mind, it's about survival. It doesn't really respond to logic in particularly effective ways a lot of the time. It can be hard to talk ourselves into this stuff because the mind just pushes back. It's scared. And if it comes to grips with one thing, if you can talk your mind into being confident about one thing, it generally, and I think we've all had this experience, it doesn't take long for it to point out some other area where maybe we could use some self-improvement. It's just what it's wired to do. By the way, it's not just wired to do that. We also model it and pass it down. We also teach our children that. It's part of our culture. If you think about commercials, you know, what is a commercial, right? They want you to get something. In order for them to convince you need it, then you have to be not good enough without it. So there's literally a whole industry designed to make you feel not good enough. The best and most talented people, the most attractive people, talented people are the ones that we normally get images of in our media. And so again, when we use this comparing tool, we're constantly up against people, I don't know, that are either prettier than us or more well-spoken or smarter or living more interesting lives. It's just what we're, and I'll wrap up here. The other people that the media show us are people that we're like, who are really struggling, who maybe the media is exposing for like ridicule or shaming in some ways, or putting forth for our own entertainment to basically kind of make fun of them. Which also just teaches our mind like, holy smokes, look what happens if you're not part of the group, is you get like shamed on an international level and you get put down. So that just also plays into this, this trap really of walking around with a human mind. You know, being human, a simple way, and this is the way the ACT books actually start of talking about this, is that it's hard to be a human being. It's challenging to walk around with these minds of ours that are so ready to criticize, to compare, to think catastrophically, and are not only hardwired, but also softwired to do so. Very, very challenging to be a human being.
So one thing I'm curious about, we've talked about a lot of really great stuff today. And some of the things that right now are standing out to me are about this idea of turning towards suffering, asking this question of ourselves, who do I want to be in this moment? What matters to me right now? Being able to slow down and really get clear on that before all this time passes and we find ourselves in these places of regret or feeling like we're living or behaving in ways that are inconsistent with our values or of what matters in terms of how we want to live, in terms of how we want to be in relationships. We've also talked about this idea of the self-critic and this background, you know, voice of, am I good enough? Am I doing this well enough? Which we've talked about sort of how that has been a survival tactic and a tool that also keeps us socially connected and part of the tribe. So I'm sort of curious, like, you know, if we were talking to someone who just said, like, I don't really know where to start with all this. I just want to start with something small that maybe an intention or a commitment that I can make just for the next 5 days to try. What might be, do you have any ideas of, and I think there are multiple answers, multiple ideas, but what's one thing that someone could say, okay, for the next 5 days, I'm going to set this intention, or I'm just going to practice and experiment with this.
That's nice. Yeah. My mind goes to a few different places. I'm going to pull back a little bit from the next 5 days piece just for a second. And I'm going to say that if this stuff appeals to you, if it sounds like something that you really are interested in, then I'd really encourage like getting a book or listening to more of Michaela and Susan's podcasts, or I'd really encourage diving in a little bit more with the intention of kind of maybe exposing yourself to a bunch of different strategies. A couple books that I recommend to a lot of people. I'm really a fan of Russ Harris's work. And he's written a couple books that inspired me. One is called The Happiness Trap. Another is called The Confidence Gap, which I just recently read. Now again, I enjoy his writing. I think he writes in a really straightforward, sensitive, kind way, and provides a lot of different tools or perspectives in that book that I think could help move forward. So I just helped Russ Harris maybe sell a book or two. But I tend to always move towards taking a little bit, or, you know, finding a therapist who you think could, who you might connect with. Or I always tend to pull towards taking a little bit of a deeper dive in this stuff, because I do feel like for people who are really suffering or really struggling, it's going to take a more committed effort, very likely, to make any sort of real change. Now, that said, if you're looking for some like little tools or little things that can be helpful, one of my favorite ones, and this is going to sound funny as a self-compassion tool because it's other oriented, but I think that tends to be a lot of ways how self-compassion works. And I would think about being, useful. Think about being, another word is helpful. And another word, I guess, would be kind. But sometimes useful is a nice word because it has like a more of a quality of action to it. And I'd keep it really simple. Our minds can get a little grandiose. And sometimes if we're suffering, it can be really, really tough to think that I might be able to be useful to another person. So we want to try and keep this really simple to get rid of all those silly games that our minds play with us. And literally try one step at a time to identify something basic, something useful that we can do for another being. And I'm even really cool with opening up what we mean by being. And, you know, it could be an animal. It could even just be another living thing, like a plant or nature in some way. Or it could be kind of a more like something like your community or like a space. I think that's a really nice tool when we're really suffering and we're down and out and we're very caught up. I use it all the time, like all the time I use it, because I get caught up in my head, you know, fairly regularly. And when I'm feeling a little bit stuck or I'm feeling like I'm not sure what to do, a really nice anchor for me has been, is there any way right now in this moment that I could be useful to someone or something else?
I love that.
And then, you know, giving it a try and seeing kind of what happens. There's no guarantees that it'll necessarily make you feel better or that it'll be appreciated or even noticed. There is a guarantee that ultimately you'll be doing something that's consistent with a broader sense of the person that you'd like to be. Because I think deep down on some level, a universal quality for all of us is that we'd like to be able to be helpful and a part of something. And so, I don't know, one little step at a time, trying to be useful, I think adds up in a big way.
I think that's great. And I also think too, I would extend that, you know, for people who feel like they're constantly striving to be useful to other people. And of course, I think that this balance varies person by person, but for good people point. Who feel like the attention and the focus is always on other people and, you know, trying to meet others' needs or be helpful to other people, I think, you know, the flip side to that coin, another useful thing is also just thinking for yourself, like, how can I be useful to me right now? How can I meet my own needs right now? Whether that's having a glass of water, you know, if I realize I've not been drinking enough water and I'm feeling dehydrated, or just taking a step back from the computer, which we're on all the time, you know, and just getting a shift in perspective, just taking a breath. I think that can be really helpful too, is also tuning back into what our own needs are in a given moment.
Thank you so much for that balanced in the perspective, Michaela. I really think that was well said.
Thank you so much for being on with us, Steve.
It's been a pleasure. The time flew by. You could tell I enjoy, I love this stuff. I find it very meaningful and enriching, even just to share it and talk about it. So I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to Compassion Collective. You can visit us on the web at compassion-collective.com. Please also consider donating to our Patreon fund at patreon.com/compassioncollective. We'll see you next time.